Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 19th of August. This hour of the program, Paul Bloom joins us again. He just is such a prolific writer and great thinker and is perfect for this show because we're the Ideas Network. And I was reading his book aloud to my family last night and they finally grew tired of me because I kept saying, oh, listen to this, listen to this, listen to this. Paul Bloom is a professor of psychology at Yale University and author of his latest book, How Pleasure Works, The New Science of Why We Like What We Like. He says right at the get-go of the book, there's an animal aspect to human pleasure. When I come back from a run with my dog, I collapse onto the sofa, she onto her dog bed. I drink a glass of cold water and she laps from her bowl and we're both a lot happier. This book is about more mysterious pleasures. Some teenage girls enjoy cutting themselves with razors. Men pay good money to be spanked by prostitutes. The average American spends over 4 hours a day watching television. The thought of sex with a virgin is intensely arousing to many men. Abstract art can sell for millions of dollars. Young children enjoy playing with imaginary friends and can be comforted by security blankets. He talks about pleasures that are uniquely human and others that are not. And there are some fascinating stories here. Paul is professor of psychology at Yale University. His research explores how children and adults understand the physical and social world with special focus on morality, religion, fiction, and art. He's also the author of Descartes' Baby, How the Science of Child Development Explains What Makes Us Human, and he writes for many scientific journals. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Professor Bloom. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, and email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Professor Bloom, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Oh, you have just so many fascinating stories in this book. It's the kind of book that you do read aloud to people because you can't, you say, can you believe this? Can you believe this? So did you think about this after you came back from the run with your dog? I wonder why this is so pleasurable.
I've often wondered about the things I do. I think, like many people, I've wondered for personal reasons, what do I like? What do I get pleasure from? Why do I like this? And why do I like that? And the book focuses largely on sort of paradoxical pleasures, pleasures that don't have obvious explanations. As you say, I think that our pleasures on the whole have an evolutionary foundation. They exist because they help us survive and reproduce, and we share them with other creatures. But there's a lot of pleasures of human life that are just a lot more puzzling, and that's what I try to discuss in the book.
Yeah, and those are get to our essence. I mean, let's talk about our essences and what this has to do with pleasure.
That's right. So the argument that runs through my book, the idea that I explore, is that for all of our pleasures, everything from the most animalistic pleasures like sex and food to more uniquely human pleasures like painting and artwork and sentimental objects, for all of these, the pleasure we get is not solely due to the perceptual properties of an object or an event. It's not just what things look like or feel like or taste like. Rather, I think our pleasure is powerfully influenced by what we believe something to be, what we believe its hidden nature or essence to be. So wine tastes much better if you think it's from an expensive bottle rather than a cheap bottle. A painting could be immeasurably more pleasurable and more valuable if you think it was by a Picasso as opposed to a forgery. An object like a wedding ring or baby shoes gets its value not from its material properties, but from what you believe to be its history, and so on and so on. For every aspect of pleasure, we are strongly influenced by our beliefs for what that thing really is.
But don't you have to be a snob in some way to believe that that painting, if you learn it's by Picasso, it's of more value? Aren't there many of us who just believe it could be a reproduction of something? It could be just a little flower or a picture of a flower that we've taken. It could be something that's not really valuable in terms of money, but to us it is incredibly pleasurable.
Well, something doesn't have to be done by a famous person to give us pleasure or have great value. Certainly right about that. But there's a lot of evidence that for all of us, even young children, the value we give to an object rests critically on what we believe its history to be. Now, in some way, that can overlap with snobbery, as when we like an object, a painting better when it was by Chagall than by an anonymous forger. But often this applies as well to simple personal objects. So I've done work with young children, for instance, that find, as parents will tell you, that they get attached to their teddy bears and security blankets, and they will not accept perfect duplicates or perfect substitutes. I've done work with adults finding that if you ask them how much they'll pay for a sweater, and you tell them that this sweater used to be owned by George Clooney,
right,
the value will shoot up.
Right.
Even if they're forbidden to tell anybody that they own this sweater or forbidden to resell it. So it's not just, you know, snob appeal or boasting rights or resale value. It's that they really want the sweater more. And so I think for all of these pleasures share a certain deep property in that they illustrate how the history of something affects how much we like it.
What is that tape measure story, the John Kennedy tape measure? How much did that sell for?
The tape measure, a tape measure from the Kennedy household, sold for about $49,000. The person who bought it said, after I picked it up, the first thing I measured was my sanity.
I'll bet.
but, you know, there's if you open a newspaper at any point, you'll find people spending huge amounts of money for objects and things that are that have no intrinsic value, but have their value because of their history. My book lists a lot of them. There's Britney Spears chewed up bubble gum, sold for quite a bit in auction. Barack Obama's half-eaten breakfast, waffles, I think, went on sale on eBay. People spend millions for baseballs that have certain historical provenance. About a year and a half ago, somebody threw his shoes at George Bush during a press conference.
Yes.
A Saudi millionaire offered, I think, $10 million for those shoes.
Goodness gracious.
Yeah. So, you know, all of these objects are valued because of their history. And I've asked people, there are some exceptions, but most people I've spoken to have at least one thing in their life, and many have many, but have at least one thing in their life that's literally irreplaceable, in that the value it has to them isn't the sort of thing you can recapture by simply creating a duplicate. Its value is historical. So, for instance, I have my children's baby shoes from when they were babies. If they were lost, I couldn't replace them. I could buy shoes that look just like them, but that's not the point. The point is that they were their shoes.
Yes. And when you look at those shoes, what happens to you? I don't know how often you look at them, but is there something... What happens when you look at them? Why are they so important? They're history, but there's something else.
Well, I think when you look at any object, what we do, whether we know it or not, and often it's unconscious, is you sort of run back through time the history of that object, particularly if it's a significant history. And the amount of liking, the visceral joy you get from any object, depends critically on facts about that history. So here's two more everyday examples. People enjoy objects more if they own them, as opposed to they don't own them.
Hmm.
And the second thing is, and this is what psychologists call the IKEA effect, we tend to like objects more if we created them ourselves. So you get somebody to put, if you put together a bookshelf, you will end up valuing that bookshelf more than if the identical bookshelf was, you bought the identical bookshelf for the same price without putting it together. The act of putting things together, the act of creating things seems to up the value of something. That's another way of seeing how the history of an object affects how we understand it.
Interesting. So this picture that I have at my kitchen, nobody in our family knows how to paint or draw or anything, but my son created what I think is a really interesting work of art when he was about, I don't know, 7 or 8. And that particular painting is more valuable to me than anything. I mean, really, I look at it every day and I think it's a great work of art in some way, and probably nobody else does, my son included. But I love it, and it is the essence of who he is, and I see him in that painting, and I always will. I'd take it, you know, if there were a fire.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. And I think that illustrates that this focus on personal history, it's not just market forces or snobbery. It's not that you love the painting because you could boast about the painting, or that because...
No, you can't boast about it.
It's this private, personal thing.
Right.
You're not going to get rich selling it on the market.
Unless he becomes famous.
Unless he becomes famous. You could always hope. and what I do in my book is I use this as one example, but there are so many other examples that illustrate the same principle. I think even for things like, you know, the taste of wine, the attractiveness of a face. You look at a face and you judge how attractive it is, physically attractive, how sexually moved you are, how romantically moved you are. And it turns turns out that depends on all sorts of other factors about who you believe the person to be.
Mm-hmm.
Is she a virgin? Is it a man or a woman? Is this somebody you like? So, for instance, even when you're asked how attractive is a person, just tell me how attractive this person is. I don't want to know about their personality or whatever, or whether they're a good person. Just physical attractiveness. It turns out that we're influenced, whether we know it or not, by how much we like the person. If you like somebody, they look better to you.
Yes. And tell us the story. Was it Darwin who wrote up a list of what was important in finding a wife? Wrote up all these characteristics, and I love the answer that kindness was giving person pleasure.
That's right. Darwin was an intellectual hero to so many of us, and a very analytic thinker. So when he was deciding whether or not to marry, he wrote a wonderful list of pros and cons. You know, and the cons were, you know, the stultifying effects of children around the house, and maybe this will interrupt his work and his science. But the pros were, you know, wouldn't it be horrible to live his whole life alone with nobody to love him? And he made some passing reference to physical contact. That might be like a good thing to have in his life. And in the end, he ended up, you know, marrying her. And the pros outweighed the cons. And if you read the pros, they're quite Darwinian, actually, in that he talks about reproduction and children and safety and so on. But he emphasizes kindness. He emphasizes deeper properties of this woman. He thought she was very beautiful, but he also knew she was kind. And there's some other work. The psychologist David Buss did this huge survey of across cultures, what do people want in a mate? And it turns out some of this is sort of cold-blooded evolutionary psychology. Women tend to want a man who's a bit older with some status. Men tend to want a woman who is of a reproductive age, who is healthy, who could bear children. But on the top of everybody's list, men and women, is kindness.
I like that so much. And what was, I'm paraphrasing him here, but maybe you know the full quote that you want to put on a bumper sticker, Kurt Vonnegut, the world, I mean, it's simple, but it's so true. The world would be so much better off if we valued kindness more. And we do, we just need to get at it, I guess.
We do. I think people often imagine that an evolutionary view of human nature is intrinsically cynical and intrinsically cold-blooded. And it can be in some regards, but I think that actually evolution guides us in ways that we view as kind of magnificent in some ways. So our love of kindness isn't some sort of freaky anti-evolutionary thing. Rather, it behooves an animal like us to be attracted to somebody who's kind, because somebody who's kind will help us, will protect us, will take care of us. We could trust them. We could rely on them with regard to our children and ourselves.
Yes.
It makes good Darwinian sense to be attracted to somebody, not just based on the geometry of their face or the shape of their body, but on their intelligence, their trustworthiness, and their kindness.
Mm-hmm. All right, we got to get to the cannibal story, much as I don't want to, but I'll warn people that this is quite a story, and you have to do it, because even the New York Times laudatory review of your book starts with a story on cannibalism, why anybody would find that, and there are lots of other things, too, cutting yourself and all these weird, very strange things that some people consider pleasurable.
I begin a chapter on food with the cannibal example, and I have had one person tell me that they stopped reading the book at that point. But there are examples of contemporary cannibals, and the example I start with was a case in Germany by this guy, Muse, I think is how you pronounce his name. And he advertised on the internet looking for somebody who would agree to be killed and eaten. And surprisingly, many people responded to him, and he chose somebody, and then I won't go over the details, but he did kill this person and eat them with their consent. And I find the psychology of cannibalism to be absolutely fascinating and absolutely and it reflects all sorts of phenomena. So I'll tell you two of them. One is, what's wrong? Why do we have such a gut reaction to cannibalism? And this shows that the taste of food and how you respond to food is affected by what you think it is. So, imagine eating some meat and knowing it to be human flesh.
Yes.
Very different. And there's all sorts of jokes and stories and parables about people who discover that what they're eating is not what they thought they were eating. Similar to the case I discussed in the sex chapter, where there's the perennial fear of a bed trick, sleeping with somebody who isn't who you thought you were sleeping with. So that's one half of it. The other half of it is, what's so good about cannibalism? Well, one reason why people are cannibals, both societies and individuals, is because they have a tacit belief that by eating human flesh, they're taking on that person's essence. They are taking on, they're not just consuming protein and calories and carbohydrates, but rather they're taking in what makes that person that person. And sometimes it's done with great respect. There are societies where they eat people, their loved ones, who die of natural causes. And it's seen as an act of respect, akin to how we in our societies will bury them or burn them. They eat them as a way to make sure that their essence, their nature, is never lost.
Hmm. And what about the psychology, getting back to that first story of saying yes to being killed and subsequently being eaten? Why would somebody find that pleasurable?
That's a great question. I don't have the foggiest idea. I have a lot to say about the psychology of the cannibal, because I think there's a bit of that in every one of us. I think you find cannibalism in modern. You find cannibalistic ideas when people think about organ transplants, because many people think an organ transplant, you imbue the essence of the person whose organ you take in. Some people would be squeamish about taking the heart and lungs of a serial killer because they believe they would take in that
yes, that's true.
That essence. And then you find, you know, there's some women, this was a short-lived craze in America, but I think it still goes on in China and parts of Europe, where they'll eat the placenta after they give birth. And there's an idea that it has special powers.
Right.
There's all these. When you start looking for modern day cannibalism, you find it all over the place. My favorite example is Keith Richards, who was asked in an interview, "What's the strangest thing you ever snorted?" And he said, "My dad." And it turned out that after his dad was cremated, he took some of the ashes, mixed it in with cocaine, and snorted it. And actually, I find that a faintly sweet story. But anyway, so the psychology of that, I think, has a lot to do with essence, has a lot to do with unconscious beliefs about people and connections with people. The psychology of why somebody would consent to being killed and eaten is, for me, a total mystery. I have nothing to say about it.
Okay. Do we start off with a fixed list of pleasures? Did we start off with that when we were first walking around, and then we add to those as we, and our pleasures change, or are they all variations on the first?
I think humans and every other creature are born with a fixed list of things we like. We like sex. We like certain foods. We like being loved. We like being safe. We like the satisfaction of curiosity. There's a list, and it's not a huge list. We like music. We like certain forms of art. Now, cultures differ a lot, and individuals differ a lot. But like you say, I think this difference is on variations on a theme. So sort of music I like would be different if I grew up in India or in some part of Africa. But I do like music. In fact, you're not going to find a human who doesn't respond, a neurologically normal human who doesn't respond with pleasure to certain tones, to certain sounds. So there's a universal pleasure, and then it varies from society to society. The sort of foods I like, given where I was raised, naturally tend towards, you know, hamburgers and pizza and so on. And they would be different if I was raised in Korea or Spain or wherever. But still, the fact that I enjoy food, and I enjoy foods that contain fat and protein and so on, that's a given. And I think the story throughout is we have a given set of things that give us pleasure, just through evolution, through our biological natures, instantiated in our physical brains. But it then comes to vary, either through cultural learning or through just individual experience or through individual genetic variation.
Hmm. And what about through age? I was interested, and we all know this to be true, that the music gets sort of imprinted on your heart or your soul, and all those wonderful experiences, first love, first time trying all kinds of things in life, that music stays with you, what you loved when you were, what, 20 and 25? Is that, why does that happen? And is that true also of or not, and if so, why not, of favorite authors or places you've seen or friendships you've had or loves that you've had at that time in your life?
Those are great questions. They're questions about the sort of critical period or the time period at which you're sensitive to the formation of different pleasures. So music is something which seems to show a fairly strong time lock. I'm sure you could find some 70-year-olds who really like Lady Gaga, but not many. I think for the most part, you could kind of, if somebody gives you a list of their musical pleasures, you could guess fairly well how old they are, because the pleasures become fixed at some point. If somebody says they like Engelbert Humperdinck, you could tell they're kind of reasonably up there in age. Lady Gaga, quite a bit younger. And so there's some fixation for music. And there's similarly some fixation for food. If you haven't had sushi by the time you're 70, you're probably not going to want to try it. People tend to be somewhat, wary of new foods. And nobody really knows the exact timing of it, and nobody knows why it happens. One, I think, reasonable theory is that food and music and certain other tastes tend to lock in at a point in our life where our social situation is becoming stabilized.
Oh.
And so, think of something like language, where our ability to learn new languages fades at a certain point because you're already in your community, you've learned your language, there's no need to spend valuable brain tissue on more learning. The window for music and art and food is longer, is bigger, and maybe has more individual differences, but that too has a window. And you could ask it for every sort of pleasure, every sort of cultural taste, and then explore what the window is. And I think that's just a totally fascinating question. And all I have at this point, because there's not that much research on it outside the domain of music, all I have is just sort of anecdote and observation. So, for instance, literary taste does seem to have a longer window. It's not so strange to see a 70-year-old being caught up on the newest literary works and reading books as they come out. Taste in clothes does tend to lock in, I think, much earlier. And we could list two dozen things and think hard about which ones people are malleable through their entire life and which ones people lock into pretty early. And then once we do that, we could try to develop a theory as to what makes these, why these different pleasures have these different time courses. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a terrific question, but honestly, it's not one we already know much about.
We're going to welcome phone calls. Our guest is the author of How Pleasure Works, The New Science of Why We Like What We Like. Paul Bloom is a professor of psychology at Yale University. He's also the author of Descartes' Baby, How the Science of Child Development Explains What Makes Us Human. We talked with him about that book some months ago. He's contributed to The Atlantic, The New York Times, and Nature. And here is our phone number. I would think we'll have a lot of interesting phone calls on this. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. In one of the reviews of this book, it's been getting rave reviews. It's described, and this is just to give you a sense of all that's in this book, although you probably have a sense of that right now. Bloom is the rare author who can rattle off references to Shakespeare, the Bhagavad Gita, recipes from the Masochist Cookbook, and Buffy the Vampire Slayer, while that ever sounding like he is trying too hard. He covers all kinds of pleasures in this book, believe me, and you may go off on some strange pleasure yourself or talk about a pleasure that we all find rather pleasurable. We welcome your phone calls. Our lines are open right now, and our email is open, 800-486-8655 is the number. The email address is talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls. Our number, 800-486-8655. Lines are open. We're speaking with Paul Bloom, his new book, How Pleasure Works, The New Science of Why We Like What We Like. Jan in Mequon, hi. Hi, Jan, are you there?
Hi, I'm sorry. We clicked out for a second.
Oh, okay.
This is fascinating, and I can't help remembering how my sisters and I, when we were young adults, kept trying to update our mother's wardrobe. She was a lovely single mom, and we wanted to bring her into, at the time, the 70s, out of, I think, the 40s. And no matter what we did, what hairdresser we took her to, she always wound up looking exactly the same.
Professor Bloom.
I think soon our time will come. I mean, there's a certain point where you just get a sense of this is the right way to look. And just and regarding pleasure, these are the right pleasures to have. These are the foods I eat. This is the art I like, and these are the clothes I like. And there's a certain point where I think it locks in, and it doesn't feel right to take on another identity. Maybe because you're sort of locked in socially as well. You've found your social community, and it's very difficult to wrench yourself away from it and lock into another one, presumably one of younger people.
Thank you very much, Jan, for your call. Let's talk more about food, because certainly we think of food as being one of the most pleasurable parts of every day. Many of us live for the next great meal that we're going to have at some part of our day. Do we love it because of the taste? Is that what it is? Is it because of associations of some kind? What is it?
Well, food's like sex, and that it's plainly the product of evolution. If you had an animal like us that didn't want to eat, it wouldn't be around for very long. Eating is essential for survival, so of course we take pleasure in eating. And we've been evolved to take pleasure from certain tastes. We love fat. We love sweet. We love, you know, the taste of meat. Baby loves the taste of breast milk, and we're drawn towards it. But food's also fascinating because it so much reveals the power of our belief system. So it is taste, I think. I think taste is the source of the pleasure. But what I'd like to suggest is that the taste of a food isn't just due to its physical properties. It isn't due to how it hits the taste buds and how it smells to you. Rather, it has to do a lot with what you believe it is. And there's dozens, maybe hundreds of demonstrations of this. My favorite one with kids is if you want to make children enjoy the taste of milk and carrots more and have them judge it as tasting better, the trick is you take them out from a McDonald's wrapper. And then they know McDonald's is good. And then this ups their expectation and actually ups their experience. With adults, the best examples have to do with wine. So I mentioned before that the more expensive a bottle of wine is, the more so you believe it to be, typically the better you'll the wine will taste to you. And there's been even neuroimaging studies where they get people inside a brain scanner and these people get to sip wine through a tube while looking at a screen that tells them all sorts of information about the wine. And if they believe the wine is cheap, their brain pleasure centers go kind of eh. But if they think it's expensive, the centers of the brain dedicated to pleasure light up. They enjoy it more because they believe it to be better wine, and so they taste it better.
Isn't that something? But we're also so easily fooled. Please tell us the Gehring story about art.
Well, the art story. So now we're moving to sort of a more unique pleasure, but the moral is going to be the same. I begin the book talking about Hermann Göring, who's Hitler's second in command. And by the end of World War II, he plundered and bought and stole many of the great artworks of Europe. And he's in Nuremberg on trial for crimes against humanity, actually about to be executed, soon to be executed. And he's told then, somebody comes and visits him in the cell, and he's told that his most prized possession, a painting he thought to be by Johan Vermeer, was actually a forgery by Van Meegeren and this great Dutch forger. And according to one biographer, when Gehring heard this, he looked as if for the first time in his life he had seen that there was true evil in the world. And now he was awful, you know, total psychopath.
Yes.
But at that point, you have some sympathy for him. I mean, imagine if you were to discover at a sort of very personal level that picture that you thought was done by your child in the kitchen was actually long ago done by somebody else and replaced. Imagine you had spent a fortune on a Vermeer, and then you discovered that it wasn't by him at all. You know, there's the feeling of being cheated, of being lied to. But even if it was an honest mistake, the value of the painting would drop to nothing. And this happens. This happens in auctions. It happens in museums where you have a painting that's valued at, you know, $20 million. And then it's discovered to be not by who you thought it was. And it becomes trash. It becomes, according to Dutch law, if you discover something to be a forgery, it can be destroyed. And what's interesting about this is that at a certain rational level, you step back and say, why should it make a difference? If you liked it before, why don't you like it now?
Right.
The colors haven't changed. The canvas hasn't changed. Nothing has changed physically. But I think the way the human mind works, and this is not something we can shake, this is just a natural way we get pleasure, is it's not the painting itself, its physical structure that gives us pleasure. It's what we believe to be its history. Who painted it? How long did it take? Under what circumstances did they do it? How creative was it? How skilled was it? And all of these factors affect the pleasure we get from it. So much so that, as in the case of Gehring, just discovering it's a forgery could strip any pleasure away from it.
Yeah. Well, you know, in some ways, that's a delightful story because at least some of his pleasure got stripped away. I mean,
yes, it's a good story of comeuppance, I guess.
Exactly.
And in fact, Van Meegeren was believed that he was selling these great Dutch masterpieces to Nazis. And so he was tried and was about to be, you know, would be sentenced to death. And then he said, look, I'm guilty, but I'm not guilty of the crime you're charging me with. I'm guilty of a lesser crime. They're forgeries. I sold them fakes. Nobody believed him, of course. So he actually sat in his cell and he said, okay, you're so good at painting Vermeers, paint one.
Right.
And so they put him in his cell. He demanded alcohol and morphine because when he was drunk and high was the only way he could do his art. So they gave him that. And reporters from all over the world watched as he painted a really damn good Vermeer. And, and this was a huge, you know, scandal because it turned out not just the painting he sold to the Nazis, but also to all sorts of paintings, the great Edward thought, you know, and a huge scandal. And in the end, he was viewed as a folk hero. He was a real sleazy and weird man. But he was, in the end, people thought of him as a hero. He was the man who swindled the Nazis.
Right. That's a great story. Maggie in Middleton, hi.
Hi. I guess I'm going to take this a little different direction. I've just tuned into part of the show, but I'm wondering how much pleasure is wrapped around this whole thing of people having OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder. And on the very light end of that spectrum, playing solitaire. I know my mother used to be late at night up at the kitchen table. She couldn't sleep, and she'd be playing solitaire. And I find that I just have this big sigh of relief when I start playing a game of solitaire on the computer. And I'm wondering, what about, I mean, just the whole thing of I don't know, this sort of repetitive but game that seems to get obsessive.
It's an interesting question. It's not something which I've studied myself, but you're certainly right that we do get pleasures in these sort of low-level repetitive actions. There's a sort of slight dopamine blast of pleasure in completing something, in setting up something and completing it. And so solitaire could be viewed as you know, 1,000 tiny puzzles, one after other, that you solve. So is a crossword puzzle or a Sudoku or all sorts of activities that are repetitive and simple and quick, and we get immersed in them, and we enjoy them. And I think that's just an interesting facet of pleasure. It also reveals a little bit about the tension between pleasure and happiness, because I don't think they're one and the same. I think that there are pleasures we can have that in the end we regret, that we don't wish to have them. And so some pleasures, OCD, the sort of satisfaction one gets from certain OCD behavior, is certainly an example, because many people wouldn't want to have this. They feel cursed by this. Addictions being another case, where people take great pleasure from eating too much and smoking and drinking and taking drugs and all sorts of things that they don't view as part of a full and happy life, but it's very hard to resist.
Here's an email, Jim from Baraboo. Why do we like beauty so much?
I don't think there's one answer to that question. I think it depends on the sort of beauty. So one facet of beauty is physical beauty. And I think we're drawn to physical beauty because physical beauty, is something that is very important, for instance, when looking for a sexual partner. Because physical beauty, beauty there is just another word for health and vitality and youth. So when we say a face is beautiful, typically what we mean is the person behind the face is healthy and is capable of having kids and protecting me and being kind to me and so on. So the features we find in a beautiful face are things like symmetry and being clear of blemishes and scars and all sorts of things that are just good signs for a person's health. But then there's a very different sort of beauty, the beauty of a sculpture or a modern art or certain paintings and certain performances. And there, I think, think for beauty, we're not so much talking about physical, it's not as linked to, say, sexual attractiveness or judging of a person's body, but rather the beauty there exists because of what we see as the genius or creativity or skill of the person creating it. So beauty, if you unpack all the things you describe as beauty, I've listed two things that would correspond to, but there's probably a dozen others. And for each of those, there's going to be a subtly different story.
Mm-hmm. Jay in Elkhorn. Hi, Jay.
Hey, Didette. Good morning.
Hi.
Good morning.
And my question was, with the Myers-Briggs personality traits that set personality types, is that something that would allow us to have a different lock-in points or a different sense of comfort in trying new things?
I think so. I think one part of pleasure, for instance, that we haven't discussed so far is the pleasure some people get from pain. I think there's a certain pleasure to be had from low degrees of pain or discomfort under certain control. Running and exercise being one example, a hot bath, sauna, horror movies and tragedies that make you scream or make you cry. We tend to like these, and that's a huge paradox. But I think part of the reason why we like these is that we're drawn to explore unpleasant circumstances, in part as a way to prepare ourselves for the future. It's a form of play. And what play is practice. It's a way to practice different realities, sometimes unpleasant realities. But then people differ a lot. And I think in the sorts of play, the sorts of masochistic pleasures that they like. And I think that would be related to their personality characteristics and their temperament. So my bet is that and I think there's some work on this, that basic personality characteristic tests will reflect whether you enjoy going to scary movies. Now, some people don't like scary movies, but other people might go to movies that make them cry. And so the sort of, you pick your own poison, you pick your own mildly aversive experiences, and the choices you make, I do think, are related to your personality.
Oh, that's interesting. Give me a cry movie anytime, but scary, wouldn't want to. We were having dinner. I was having dinner with friends last night, and we were talking. I didn't even know these things existed. When you talk about pain, people who sign up for these and go all the time on these 5-day trips, and they're testing your body, and you're going into caves, and you can only sleep 1 hour a day. But many people don't do that because the object is to win. And you're putting yourself through this great physical adversity. Holy Toledo, that sounds like hell to me.
That's right. And those cases are, I think, very rich. It would be too simple to say it's pain for pain's sake. These are different sorts of people than those who pay other people to whip them or spank them.
Right.
There's a goal. But I think, and the satisfaction of achieving a goal. But I think if the goal didn't have the pain and the suffering and the deprivation in it, it would be nowhere near as satisfying. Often, we're very smart and imaginative creatures, and often we'll set ourselves circumstances where we have to go through some degree of misery in order to achieve what we want to achieve. And that achievement is so much more pleasurable by the fact that we've gone through that misery.
And why would somebody find pleasure? We need to explore this more. Paying people to spank them.
Well, the question, so I'm mostly interested in what Paul Rozin, psychologist Paul Rozin, calls benign masochism, everyday masochism of going to a hot bath or eating hot chili. Then you get to the more unusual and more interesting cases of people who pay others to hurt them or to humiliate them. And I think one aspect of the story is that we're very moral creatures. This is sort of another aspect of the mind I study, but we're naturally inclined to reward those who we see are good and punish those we see are bad. And I wonder if some of the masochistic behavior we see is a desire to punish oneself. And there's some actual experimental evidence in support of this. This is work done by David Pizarro and Dan Ariely and their colleagues, where what they do is they get people in the lab and they hook them up to an electric shock machine and they let them shock themselves. People love to do this. They will shock themselves. They have the option of not doing anything and saying this is ridiculous, but they'll give themselves mild shocks. What's interesting about this study is, for some of these people, they asked them to recall an event in which they had behaved badly. And it turns out after you do that, and then you hook yourself up to the shock machine, people shock themselves more. as if they were punishing another person.
Themselves.
The punishment is now directed towards themselves. And I wonder if certain episodes of more interesting and more unusual masochism are sort of basically you're punishing the bad guy, except the bad guy is you.
Huh. More phone calls in a moment. Our guest this hour is the author of How Pleasure Works, The New Science of Why We Like What We Like. Paul Bloom, professor of psychology at Yale University and also author of Descartes' Baby, How the Science of Child Development Explains What Makes Us Human. We have some lines open if you'd like to join us. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, and email address in case you'd like to communicate that way, talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our next caller is Winna from Galesville. Hi, Winna.
Hi there. I'm calling because I want to go back to the part about the wine tasting and the paintings, and I believe that your guest said everyone would respond the same way, and yet my husband and I both scoff at high-priced things and like things for what they are, and I wonder if it's a certain type of person or what the explanation is for that.
Well, I often hear that response, and I can't tell of any individual case. You and your husband may be the unusual cases that really don't care and aren't influenced by information like where a wine came from, how much it costs, what other people say about it, and so on. I'm just skeptical. It turns out that most people think that this doesn't apply to them.
Mm-hmm.
So when you taste wine, you say, "I'm tasting it. You know, I'm. It's on my tongue. I'm smelling it." That's doing the judgment. But it just so happens that 100 people who are told it's an $8 bottle of wine will like it less than 100 people told it's a $40 bottle of wine. I'll also add that the effects of background knowledge of what you think on your experience don't always have to go the same way. So it's possible, for instance, that somebody who is more down to earth, sees himself as particularly not snobbish, might actually be affected in the opposite direction, where they might enjoy things more if they're cheap.
Oh, interesting, yes.
I know this is true for consumer products in general. I know there are people I know in New York who are quite wealthy, and their idea of fun is to get bargains. So they travel, they don't need to, but they spend a lot of time trying to get bargains. And my bet is that they enjoy something more, this time not because it costs a lot, but because it costs a little. And they take pride in their acquisition. And they get pleasure from it, knowing that it was inexpensive. And maybe something like that could happen for food and wine as well.
Mm-hmm. I think that's true for many of us, that we get great pleasure in finding bargains.
That's right. Or, you know, I could imagine, you know, there's always... Suppose you have two objects and they're the same, and one you paid for, and one was stolen, one you stole. My feeling is that would make a difference. Now,
yes.
I don't know which way it would make a difference. That might depend a lot on who you are. The stolen object might be a source of shame, and it will devalue it. On the other hand, it may be a source of exhilaration and pride, and you might get more pleasure from it. But it would make a difference.
Thanks, Winna, for the call. Charles on the road. Hello, Charles.
Hi, good morning. I'm wondering about the psychology behind the German term Schadenfreude, which is taking pleasure in other people's pain. Certainly the extreme of that might be sadism, but the other extreme is just the more mundane, the phenomenon of America's stupidest home videos where we take great pleasure in watching people, you know, fall off skateboards and such. I'm just wondering what that's about in our brains.
So much of our pleasures are social, and that could be very nice. It could be the pleasure we get when somebody we love, like our child, does something great. It can be this great rush of pleasure, the pleasures of affection, of love. But there's an ugly side to the social nature of pleasure, and this is that we are hierarchical creatures. There are these presumably apocryphal stories of people who go into salary negotiations and say basically, look, I don't care exactly how much money I make. I just got to make $100 more than the next guy. There's a pleasure then in being on the top. And you can't be on the top of everybody, but there might be a pleasure of seeing somebody who is and watching them and knowing, feeling superior. And I think a lot of this sort of, that's a lot which goes into the pleasure we get from the failures of others. and the pleasure we get from TV shows like, you know, America's Funniest Home Videos, we watch people slip and fall. And we think, you know, well, at least I'm not that schnook.
Exactly. Thanks, Charles. Let's go to Michael in Rice Lake. Hi, Michael.
Hi. I am calling to ask Professor Bloom if he can comment, please, on the neurobiology of certain psychiatric or psychological diseases in which the individual afflicted is unable to experience any sort of pleasure.
Hmm.
I can't. I know there are such disorders. They're often caused by brain trauma, by stroke. And I'm not sure in the end that these disorders are properly viewed as disorders of pleasure as opposed to disorders of mood in general, as a form of general depression. So it's not clear that these people literally lose the pleasure of orgasm or the pleasure of taste of wine. But what they might lose is they might just get a general malaise, a general decline of interest, a general loss of activity, and so on. And so, again, this shows how pleasure and happiness are intimately related. But when it comes to talking about a neurological disorder or a psychiatric disorder, it might be valuable to try to pull it apart. And my guess would be that these are not disorders of pleasure, but rather disorders of mood or happiness.
Let's talk a little bit more about sex and about pornography. Why is it that some people really have problems with and spend much more time looking at images of pictures of people who are naked and sometimes some images that are not very healthy, I think, rather than being engaged with another human being?
Yeah, pornography and food are similar in this regard. So in a case of sex, we've evolved to respond in certain ways with pleasure to, say, seeing attractive naked people or certain sexual events or sexual experiences. And in the world in which we've evolved in for 99.99% of our evolutionary history, those are real people. And so this was a useful, you know, this helped animals and humans have sex, and that was a good thing from a reproductive point of view. But now we're very smart creatures, and we've created stimuli that fool the brain, that fool us into thinking they're real. So if I want to see an attractive naked person, I could type that phrase into Google Images, and boom, my page, the screen will be filled with attractive naked people. And so what used to be something complicated and difficult we strive for sexual, real-life sexual experiences, is now accessible to any of us in a second. And it is such a powerful stimulus that it's a wonder why some people ever leave their houses. And it could lead to sort of serious social and personal problems.
Right, exactly.
It's exactly the same for food. So we've evolved a love of sweet things, presumably because fruit and other foods are sweet and they're high caloric density. And in the environment in which we evolved, we were constantly starving to death. And so we had this tremendous hunger, and if you could eat something, that'd be terrific. But now, just sort of on analogy with internet porn, I can go into local 7-Eleven and gorge myself on sweet things that are not very expensive, chocolate bars and candies and high-protein nuts and everything. And unless one wants to become incredibly obese, we have to block that. So in some way, we have these appetites, and these appetites have evolved for a world in which these things are naturally scarce, where food and sex are hard to get and well worth getting. But in our modern world, these are extremely accessible, and that poses a modern dilemma. And the dilemma being, we have to block our natural proclivities if we're going to live a full and happy life.
Thank you, Michael, for the call. We have a minute left. Sam in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. I have a quick question. I've noticed that, and I think like most people, when I hear about crimes that are perpetrated against children, it bothers me, especially considering that I have two young children of my own. But I notice that I will go to CNN, and I will check to see if there has been any, you know, such thing that's happened recently where a crime has been committed against a child. And when I see that there's not anything there, I'm relieved.
Yes.
But when I do see something there, it really bothers me, and it plays over in my mind, but I wonder why I seek that out. And I'm wondering, is it possible that I'm deriving some type of pleasure from that? But it's not a pleasurable thing for me. It bothers me, but I wonder why.
All right, Sam, we have about 15 seconds or so.
You put your finger on a great question. It's sort of the mother kills three-year-old question. Given how upsetting we find this, why would we click on that when it shows up on our screen? And it's a hard question. I think that the answer is going to come down to we have an appetite for worst-case scenarios. It's because you think it's so terrible that you're so driven to be interested in it, because from an evolutionary point of view and a functional point of view, this stuff you is very important for you to know. So you have a hunger for knowing it, even if it's information in the end that's going to depress you, and you'd rather not, at some level, learn more about it.
Mm. The always fascinating Paul Bloom. Thank you so much for being with us, Professor Bloom.
Thank you so much for having me on.
His book is How Pleasure Works, The New Science of Why We Like What We Like. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing this hour, and thanks to Rhonda Fanning as well for producing last hour. I never had a chance to thank her, so I'm thanking her now. If you'd like to go to our Facebook page, we have some interesting comments from listeners there. If you want to look at it, it's The Kathleen Dunn Show. And thanks, everybody, for all of your calls.